turnaround at Express appears to be continuing, even as the Delta variant weighs on the return to offices and nights out on the town. Express said this week comparable sales for the second quarter rose 3% from the second quarter of 2019. Gross profit margins gained 580 basis points versus the second quarter of 2019. Joining us now is Express CEO Tim Baxter, fresh off his closely watched Investor Day. Tim, good to see you again. Let's start with quarter-to-date trends. You did not hide from the fact that business has continued to accelerate from mid-July. What is driving the inflection point in your business, and are you still seeing double-digit sales gains in August?
Yes, we are. I used one word in our earnings call to describe the second quarter, and that was acceleration. We saw consistent acceleration throughout the quarter. To your point, we, in the period after the 4th of July, drove an 11% increase versus the same time period in 2019. And we have seen that double-digit comp increase continue into August. So really excited about the traction that our strategy is gaining. And consumers are responding incredibly favorably to what we're doing.
What categories are driving those gains this month?
You know, what's really exciting, Brian, is we set out to build a much more versatile assortment. And at the beginning of the quarter, we were seeing incredible comp increases in categories like denim. We know that denim is the foundation of any modern wardrobe. We drove a 21% comp increase over 2019 in our denim category, and that was consistent throughout the quarter. We also have been driving incredible comp increases in categories like knits, one of the most versatile categories for both men and women. Our body contour collection in women's has been, you know, really a game changer for us. And both of those categories were incredible throughout the quarter. But the real change in momentum came late in the quarter as we began to see a real acceleration in categories that we've long been known for, like men's suits, men's dress shirts, women's dresses. Those categories, while they were down 12% for the total quarter, the real change in momentum happened when those categories started performing closer to flat. And we've also seen that trend continue into August.
Hey, Tim, it's Julie here. So you're talking about the change that you guys have been making in the stuff in the stores. I want to talk to you about the stores themselves as well. Yeah. And what shoppers can expect in terms of what their store experience is going to be like, how it may change, and what the store footprint overall is also going to be like.
All right, so let me start with the store footprint. We have two things that we're doing as a part of fleet optimization. And, you know, we announced a strategy to close 100 stores. We've gotten about 93. We will have about 93 of those closed by the end of the year. But we're also our mall-based fleet. You know, we've been experimenting with making our fleet more productive. And we, our King of Prussia store outside of Philadelphia, we actually shrunk the store by 45%, completely remodeled it. And we saw a 12% comp increase in that store in versus 2019 in 45% less space. So we know that we can be much more productive in our mall-based fleet. And we are right now remodeling our North Park store. You're seeing images right now of the screen of that store in King of Prussia. And so we're going to continue to do that. The second piece of our optimization strategy is the Express Edit concept. We've got about five of these smaller stores open now. They are smaller footprints, all less than 4,500 square feet. And these are off-mall locations and in heavily trafficked foot areas. And we've seen incredible response. This that you're seeing on the screen now is one of those Express Edit stores in Washington, D.C. We've seen incredible response in these stores. They're exceeding our expectations. The most incredible thing that we're seeing in these stores is that 50% of the customers in these locations are new to Express, which is really exciting. In terms of the experience itself, customers can expect much cleaner stores. And by cleaner, I mean more spacious, easier to navigate stores. They tell us that's what they want. They can expect larger fitting rooms, more comfortable fitting rooms. We're starting to install call buttons in all of our fitting rooms so that they can get associate help whenever they need it. They can expect to find new lounge areas because they continue to tell us they want places to sit. So some things that are really, really simple, but we're moving forward with to improve the in-store experience.
And Tim, staying on the topic of stores, I'm curious about the outlet footprint. You guys are only looking to close, I think, five stores there in 2021 versus 20 for the regular retail outlets. Where's the outlet kind of fit in the future of retail here? I remember when I was a kid, it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen, this outlet mall, and it's had some evolutions the last 20 years. How do you guys think about it?
Look, our outlet business, we spent a tremendous amount of time, and actually the second quarter is the first time we actually got our outlet assortments. You know, we really focused on our retail assortments first, and then started focusing on our outlet assortments. And it's the first time we really got our outlet assortments aligned with the Express Edit merchandising and design philosophy. And the results were incredible. We had a record second quarter in outlets. We drove a 7% comp increase in the outlet business. And what's really exciting about all of this is, as you think about our larger strategy, we're going to continue to pull back on major deep site-wide and store-wide promotions in our retail business. And as we do that, the outlet channel becomes much more viable. You know, you talk about it was the greatest thing you ever found. That was because, you know, the value there was incredible. So what we're doing is improving the product and still delivering incredible value there, and the customer's responding. I mean, it's that same kind of feeling that you had when you used to shop at outlets. So we're bullish on our outlet business as we continue to elevate in our regular price stores. You know, we drove a 25% increase in average unit retail in the second quarter. And so as we continue to do that, the outlet business is going to become more and more important as the value channel for the Express consumer.
Tim Baxter, Express CEO. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Tim. Appreciate it. And Express shares have been waning a little bit in recent days, but they had definitely a resurgence this year, as you can see. And then some, 578%. Tim, thanks so much for being here. Good to catch up with you. We will talk to you again soon as you continue on the store revamps and some of the other endeavors that you've been doing.
Peloton shares are under pressure following the company's latest earnings and outlook. The company saw some slowing in subscriber growth, cut the price of its entry-level bike by $400, and said it wouldn't be profitable on an adjusted operating profit basis for its new fiscal year. Peloton also disclosed it uncovered a material weakness in its accounting for inventory valuation. Let's unpack all this with Peloton CFO Jill Woodworth. Jill, always good to speak with you. Thanks for taking some time this morning here. Let's start with the decision to cut the price on the bike. Why does that move make sense? And is it a reflection of just a more heightened competitive environment for at-home fitness equipment?
Great question. You know, if you look back over the last several years, we have always had the aim of making our products more accessible. We introduced zero APR financing 4 years ago. We introduced a 30-day free home trial a couple of years back. And we've also cut the price of our digital app as well. And so it's been largely academic until now to be able to make a big price move. As you can imagine, over the last several years, we've essentially sold every bike that we could make. And over the last couple of months, of course, the pandemic forced us to really grow our manufacturing base 8 or 9 times over during the pandemic. And so we're finally in a place from an inventory perspective where we can actually enact a dramatic price change to really open up the accessibility of our products. So we're really excited about it.
Jill, it's Julie here. Just to follow up on the pricing a little bit, it seems like it really took the street off guard. Was there a matter of maybe you guys could have done a little bit better job preparing people for this price cut? And if you could, give me a little bit more color around how you were able to cut the price. Where, I mean, we talk to CEOs every day who are rising input costs and then are raising costs. So I think it's notable in this bigger environment to see someone cut the price and cut it by so much for a flagship product.
Well, I think it underscores, frankly, a lot of consistent themes that we've communicated over the last several years. And First and foremost being the fact that we are prioritizing subscription growth and household penetration. And so with this price move, you know, we think this is a great way to expand our addressable market and get more people into the Peloton ecosystem. And again, it's been something we've consistently said that as we move forward and we have taken a lot of costs out, especially of our original bike where we have our most mature supply chain, we've taken these costs out. And so we've always said that when we are able to, we will make our products more affordable. So I don't necessarily think there's anything surprising about the move.
Jill, it's Miles here. I wanted to ask a little bit about the costs associated with the Tread recall. You guys have the line item in there. And I guess how you think about that risk across the portfolio now going forward as something that, you know, could come up from time to time, given these are, you know, sophisticated pieces of equipment that you're seeing millions of go out the door.
So we're excited about the launch of our lower price Tread. As you know, in collaboration with the CPSC in the US, we now have the approved repair for the touchscreen for that lower price Tread. And for us, as you know, safety is paramount for us and for our members. And so we also rolled out Treadlock, which is a passcode that is now required to turn the Tread on. And we believe with these remedies, we have the safest treadmill on the market, and those the treadmills will go on sale next week. But for us, again, it's just all about safety for our members, and we feel really good about our remedy. And of course, we will always be looking for ways to enhance the safety of our products.
Jill, just given the Tread recall, will you have to cut the price on the treadmill as well?
At this juncture, we have no plans to change the pricing of either our higher end bike, our Bike Plus, or our Tread, but certainly over time, especially when we're able to move our manufacturing base more domestically with the Peloton Output Park that we announced a couple of months back. We are very excited about the cost efficiencies that we will see on that lower price Tread over time.
And Jill, on the accounting issue that was mentioned up in the release, now, why do you think this happened, and will you have to restate any financials because of it?
Yeah, so first of all, we are not restating financials. We had some manual errors in documentation, and the discrepancy was not at all material. And as you can imagine, we're already investing in remediation efforts here. So this again is not impacting our financial statements and will not result in any restatement of our historical results.
Jill, I want to ask you about subscribers as separate from the hardware for a moment. You guys ended last quarter with 2.33 million connected fitness subscribers, total members 5.9 million, which I assume also means other people who used those subs in those households. And then 874,000 digital-only subs is my understanding. Hopefully I have all these numbers right. Of those digital subs, I know you guys have been offering some complimentary subscriptions. How many of those are paying? I know these are higher margin, you know, the subscriptions are higher margin than the hardware. So talk to me through those numbers and how you think about them.
Yeah, so we love the digital subscription business, largely because a lot of those digital members end up buying a bike and hopefully will end up buying a Tread and converting into connected fitness. It's actually our fastest growing sales channel. And so, you know, we do have efforts to continue to grow our digital app business. This is also going to be an integral part of our corporate wellness program, where a lot of corporations are very interested in subsidizing access to our digital membership. So this will be a key lever for us to use as we drive our corporate wellness business.
All right, let's leave it there. Peloton CFO Jill Werworth, good to see you this morning. We appreciate you coming on and talking about this stuff.
Well, in today's Crypto Corner, we are focusing in on Ether as we're watching that cryptocurrency pop a bit today around the $3,200 level. You'll remember back in January when Ether was trading close to about $1,200, our next guest predicted that we could see the mid-3,000s next. And lo and behold, we hit exactly that just a few months later. So where could prices go from here? Let's bring her back in to find out. A pleasure to welcome back into the show Megan Casper, Magnetic Managing Director, joining us right now. Megan, you know, last time you were on with us, we were talking about ETH potentially hitting $10,000 by the end of the year. We came down maybe a little bit from the all-time highs we saw earlier. But are you sticking by that 10K call?
Hey, Zach. Yeah, I am. You know, when we look at it in two dimensions from supply and demand, investors are still using crypto as a favored tool for a hedge against inflation, as the U.S. may or may not be continuing to print infinity amount of U.S. dollars. So it's a great tool against the deflation aspect. And then also, Ethereum is becoming a deflationary asset. So you have Bitcoin, which is sort of this fixed asset, and then Ethereum, like I said on our last call, we have two network upgrades, one of which has already been initiated on June 5th, which basically changed the mining fees on the network. And then towards the end of the year, beginning of next year, we'll have about 1 million worth of Ethereum coming out of supply. So that initially, that will initiate it becoming a deflationary asset. And yes, that's why we're looking at it. You know, the 8 to 10 price call is still very much a possibility.
Yeah, so much of that, you know, is changing now. And you think back to when people were still thinking about there's no fundamentals here in crypto. Obviously, I think 2021 has proved that wrong. 2020, a lot more people maybe jumped on the bandwagon here. But when you look at it, NFTs are kind of hard to not bring up when we look at what's going on Ethereum, the network itself, because just the numbers are pretty staggering to highlight. In August, you know, we hit record levels of people spending money on these NFTs. And, you know, it's still being debated whether or not there's actual value in these things. A lot of people comparing them to Beanie Babies and things like that. But you can't really not focus in on that when you see that many money or that much money flowing into it. So what's your take there in terms of whether or not that's kind of supportive of Ethereum pricing too here, if that's what all this is priced in?
Major support. You know, just in August alone, we had $900 million worth of NFT sales on Ethereum. All of this NFT community has really proliferated crypto as an asset class, but the community itself is pretty new just as of 2021. And I think we'll continue to see that expand as the real world applications for NFTs come alive in immersive and shareable interactive ways.
Yeah, I mean, just maybe to back up, because some people watching might be confused by what NFTs even are. You know, non-fungible tokens, it can include a lot of things. Maybe something with use cases when you think about collectibles that can give you access to events, but also it includes this particular one here. We talked about Ether Rocks, basically a clip art of a rock, and that one there sold for more than $1.7 million. So some of this is pretty crazy, Megan. But I mean, it's all looped into that. You know, this is where the money is going. I mean, are you kind of surprised the new projects that have popped up, or how are you seeing that kind of evolve now?
No, I mean, we've had just in the last month alone, 19 different NFTs sell for over $1 million. So I think we'll continue to see this as the younger generation feels comfortable buying and owning assets that are not physical. And that, again, is sort of the tech trend that we're moving towards in dematerialization. And that, again, is another reason why this asset class will continue to grow. We're only at a $2 trillion market cap right now. Back in January on our call, we were at one. And like I've always said, I believe in the next few years, we'll be at a $10 trillion market cap.
Well, you haven't been wrong yet, so it's hard to kind of disagree with the things that you say on the show. But when you look at maybe if people don't want to get into in specific NFTs, I know you've talked about certain chains maybe levered more towards where NFTs could go if that really does start to take off. Wax, one of the projects you mentioned, your co-founder at Magnetic, also behind. I mean, talk to me about maybe that's the best play to play this space if you don't really want to own them specifically, maybe what the advice would be to new investors coming on board.
Wax is a great platform. So is Binance. There are a lot of other chains that are creating communities around NFTs. And I think that if you're a part of this creator economy and launching an NFT, the best advice would be launch your NFTs on every chain, because not all the chains are interoperable yet. And if you're a trader, you know, follow the trends, get into the Discord channels, get into the Twitter accounts of the top NFT traders. This is really the best way to follow the community. These kids are living in the metaverse and trading and creating an entire new way of commerce, all in this ecosystem.
One last question too for me. I mean, we've seen kind of everything move, I guess, in tandem in the past, but now finally some cryptos kind of breaking from the trends. Even when Bitcoin's down, you might see some other side projects start to take off. I mean, where do you think we are in terms of the cycle of maybe institutional money now starting to shift away? We've seen a lot of funds pop up here, focusing in on more fringe projects, if you want to call them that, thinking Solana and maybe some of the other things that are getting built out now. I mean, how fast is that maybe institutional side quickly changing here in 2021 when we thought about maybe an ETF getting approved, but now people focusing in on some more niche products?
Well, those bigger macro things are still happening. You know, $17 billion of VC capital has gone into crypto projects. And I think it'll sort of trickle down. It'll have a top-down effect. The larger institutions and the ultra wealthy becoming more involved in the space. And as people become more aware, they'll gain exposure into other smaller assets and chains, which will help grow those ecosystems. When you look at Solana, Cardano, Binance, these ecosystems have all experienced over 2,000% returns this year alone, which is higher than Bitcoin and Ethereum. So yeah, I suspect that we'll see this proliferate.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to ignore as they continue to take off here this year. We didn't talk about Doge though, so there is that. But Megan Casper, Magnetic Managing Director, appreciate you coming back on. We'll keep our eyes on that 10K price target, have you back on and check in. Welcome back in to Yahoo Finance Live as we enter an interesting chapter here, both for the markets and for the economy as a whole. Plus, for companies out there trying to navigate the return to the office amidst the spread of Delta on the COVID front. And as we've seen, Delta Airlines started an interesting strategy here to charge unvaccinated employees an extra $200 when it comes to health care. Also trying to deliver on what President Biden has called for when it comes to private and public companies stepping up to help in vaccination efforts and incentives there. And for more on that, I want to bring on Rich Lesser, Boston Consulting Group CEO, joins us right now. And Rich, it's good to be chatting with you again here, specifically about kind of, I guess, the role that companies need to be playing here. It's a bit tricky, you know, whether you're bringing employees back into the office or not, but clearly playing a larger role here when it comes to incentivizing vaccinations.
So can we start by grounding ourselves in what's going on with Delta right now? Because I really don't think it sets the stage for what companies need to do. The Delta variant is just much more transmissible than the earlier variants that came through. 2.5 to 3 times more transmissible than the wild strain that we were all talking about when COVID first hit. And as a result, it's running through communities dramatically. It may also be more severe in addition to being more transmissible. It's less clear on. But the result is enormous impact. So let me just highlight a couple of things that are really important. First, we now have data from multiple states around the country and from the CDC. If you are vaccinated, age adjusted, so like for like age, you're about 20 times less likely to end up in the hospital than if you are unvaccinated. And that's true whether you're in a state with a lot of infection right now or a state with relatively low infection. The second thing that's true is that communities can protect themselves. If you take the states that are in the top 12 of vaccination and you compare it to the states that are in the bottom 12 of vaccination, the infection rates by age group are about 4 to 5 times worse in the more infected states than they are in the less infected state. I mean, in the more vaccinated states, you have about a fourth or a fifth of the infection rates that you do in the low vaccination states. So it's enormous impact to protect our communities. And what it means is if you're vaccinated in most parts of the country, it's at or below what it feels like in peak flu season. In many parts of the country, way below peak flu season. And if you are unvaccinated, it's dramatically worse than it was last winter. Now that brings us to companies. Companies are realizing this and public sector, and we need to protect people to a greater degree, and we need to raise the cost of being unvaccinated. And we see a range of actions designed to do that.
Yeah, and I wonder too, I mean, in your discussions with business leaders here, you know, so much of this has been focused in on cases, right? That was kind of the number we were watching here. But to your point, you know, people out there, even if you are vaccinated, might get COVID. But the experience is far better than what could have happened if you weren't. I would be case in point. I was a breakthrough infection, down for a few days, but still, you know, it wasn't impacted that much. And when we look at maybe how businesses might be reacting to that, we keep hearing more and more timelines getting pushed back in terms of when, if there is an office still, when they'd be going back in. So what are you hearing maybe in terms of how companies maybe will be shifting away from, you know, the earlier rules around cases in the office and what maybe the hybrid model is still looking like now?
So first of all, I just want to reinforce your point. We focus much more on hospitalization rate than we do on infection rate. You know, we don't spend our lives talking about who got a cold or who got a very mild symptom flu. You talk about where it's serious and where people's lives are at risk, or you're taking up valuable hospital capacity. So that is an important thing to think about right now. I think most companies are doing two things. One is they're upping the cost for being unvaccinated. Some have gone to full mandates. Some have gone to paying for part of your healthcare. The Delta Airlines announcement from Ed Bastian thought was quite interesting and important in the way they framed it for their employees. Some are going to a vax or test even every twice a week or every day, as well as wearing masks in the office. So we're trying to raise the cost of being unvaccinated. And the second is, in many cases, it's leading to a pushback of when you can get people back into the offices. I think all of us are trying to get our people back together as fast as we can. May not be full time, 5 days a week, but to get our community sort of reconnected. But Delta's slowing that down. And, you know, then you see varying rates of how people do that, whether make it more voluntary to come back in or actually just be very clear that they're going to slow it happening. For me right now, job one is all around vaccination and everything we can do to encourage it. And employers have a big role to play, but for sure the government has an even bigger role to play at state and local as well as federal levels.
Yeah, the roles on the local level here are very different depending on which state you're in there in terms of how some of these restrictions are going to be implemented here. But just lastly, I mean, when we think about where we are in this recovery, you were just listening to, before we got on here live, we were listening to the discussion there with Philadelphia Fed President Patrick Harker, focusing in on the supply and demand issues here, saying that a lot of what we're seeing right now is more of a supply issue. And I do wonder your take when we look at growth coming out of this, if we do see a pushback in timeline of getting back to normal and costs continue to saddle some of these companies, when you think about the healthcare costs associated with COVID, what you think about maybe how this recovery is going, what it'll look like in the next quarter or two?
I still remain very optimistic about the economic recovery that's underway. Individual sectors and individual communities could well be impacted by Delta, but what we've seen through the really effective policy actions by the Fed, by the federal government, by others around the world, we've decoupled the ability to be economically vibrant from the impact of COVID. The fastest way to get back onto full steam growth ahead is, of course, to get beyond COVID. But actually, the underlying growth prospects remain very good for the economy. We're dealing with the supply challenges right now, supply of labor, supply of goods. Your last conversation highlighted both of those, and they're very real. So I'm not minimizing the disruptive nature in the short term, but the underlying growth prospects are high, and we remain very confident around.
I like to leave it on a positive note, so we'll leave that there. Rich Lesser, Boston Consulting Group CEO, appreciate you coming back on to chat. Have a great weekend.
Before the Delta surge, Black and Hispanic Americans were nearly three times more likely to be hospitalized and twice as likely to die from COVID than white Americans. That's according to the CDC. And while the more infectious Delta strain has pushed more minorities to get vaccinated, advocates say not enough shots are getting into arms to close the racial gap on new infections and hospitalizations. Joining me now is Dr. Sachin Jain, president and CEO of Scan Health Plan. We're also joined by our health reporter, Anjali Kamlani. Thanks to you both for being with us. Dr. Jain, just, I guess, bring us up to date on what vaccination rates are like right now among minority communities in this country.
So vaccination rates are trending up right now for all communities, but at the same time, we continue to see persistent gaps between African-Americans and Latinx members of our community when you compare them to Caucasian members. So we, as a health plan, have made a major focus reducing that disparity. And over the last several months, we've been able to use a number of different strategies to reduce our disparities across multiple different populations, including Black, Latinx, and low-income members of our health plan, because we believe that this is the number one thing we can do to support the health of the patients that we serve.
Dr. Jain, I want to ask you a little bit about another program that I know is near and dear to your heart, and that is the efforts on homelessness. On one hand, we heard the U.S. Supreme Court come down with the decision that the CDC's eviction moratorium was more or less government overreach, and it has to end. And it's consistent with what we've seen across the board, whether you're looking at Florida or Texas and how the courts there have handled mask mandates, or rather the bans on some of these mandates. So I just wonder if you could parse through that and sort of what the implications of this are as you watch the homelessness.
I think one of the biggest challenges that we have in our society is we've mischaracterized homelessness as a housing issue, when in fact, I do believe it is a healthcare issue first and foremost. I think many people find themselves homeless because of some underlying healthcare issues, whether they be chronic diseases that are untreated, mental health issues, addiction. And we don't necessarily have a healthcare system that is particularly good at proactively addressing these issues. And as a result, many people find themselves untreated and homeless. At the same time, I think being homeless actually exacerbates underlying chronic disease and illness. I think one of the things we have to do is really reframe this issue away from being a housing supply issue and start to think about it more like the healthcare issue that it is. And if you actually redefine how we solve this issue, it'll actually change how we think about solving it. One of the things that we've focused on is building new sustainable payment models that will allow us to actually deliver street-based healthcare to people who are experiencing homelessness. And we think, you know, in the context of COVID-19, in the context of all of these regulatory challenges, these are the types of solutions that are ultimately going to help address this issue.
Tell me a little bit more about how you're able to do that, because, you know, if you just look at it at face value, you're a Medicare Advantage plan. Why are you getting involved in this? And how are you able to basically roll out these programs, reimburse for them, et cetera?
Well, it really goes down to how Medicare Advantage plans are actually reimbursed for healthcare services. Traditional payment for healthcare is fee for service. If you get sick and you land in a hospital, the hospital gets reimbursed for the care that is delivered to the patient. In Medicare Advantage, many provider groups operate under what's called prospective payment. And so what we're doing is wherein you take the total cost of healthcare, the average total cost of healthcare for a year, you give it to a provider group, and then that provider group manages all of your care, your outpatient care, your inpatient care. In doing so, it creates a much greater incentive towards prevention. And that's why we founded this group, Healthcare in Action, which is part of the SCAN group and a sister entity to SCAN Health Plan, is to allow us to do more of the intensive outpatient management that's less expensive and better for patients, as opposed to paying for costly hospitalizations. So it's really cost shifting away from expensive inpatient care that is oftentimes the side effect of bad outpatient care to investing more heavily in outpatient care for patients.
You know, Doctor, I just want to get back to the vaccination among minorities issue for a moment and how, you know, what needs to be done to convince that segment of the population to get the shot? Do you believe that it's going to have to come from friends and leaders within the community and people that those minority groups trust versus even, say, science and doctors?
I think it's a multi-pronged strategy. I think you're absolutely right. I think community leaders have an important role to play in reducing, in addressing the misinformation that exists around COVID vaccinations. I think it's also very important for us to make it as easy as possible. One of the things that we did at SCAN was we partnered with a company called MedArrive that actually delivers home-based vaccinations to any of our patients who want them. And this actually reduces a substantial barrier. Some people say, I'm not necessarily willing to go out there. They're afraid of actually getting vaccinated. They're afraid of actually being in the community. We've made people afraid of actually leaving their homes. And so by actually sending the vaccination into the home and in many affected communities, we're actually able to increase vaccination rates. And so I think that's been an important strategy. The other thing is just making information as easily available as possible. I think people have multiple sources of information and they don't know who to trust anymore. And, you know, one of the things we have as a longstanding nonprofit trusted health plan in the community is we have that trust with patients. And so we have put ourselves forward as a source of information and have a 24/7 vaccine access line. And we will go so far as actually scheduling the appointment for the individual, which again is another barrier. If you've actually tried to get vaccinated, you know how difficult it sometimes is to use online systems, to call a pharmacy. There's oftentimes no one available to answer the call for you. We're doing all of that hard work for you. And so by actually making ourselves that available, making it easier to actually access the vaccination, we're lowering the barriers that many people in low-income communities actually face.
I want to get your thoughts on something really quickly, Dr. Jane, and that is just generally the federal government messaging and how two parts, so you can choose which part you want to address. But on one hand, we have reports now that we may have boosters 5 months after, recommendations for 5 months after the initial course. But there's also been, you know, a decision about 8 months and then 6 months and how confusing that might be and what you have to do to get through that. Simultaneously, we're looking at, you know, going back to the Florida and Texas, the idea of mandates coming from guidance in most of the rest of the country. And then you have sort of state level politicians deciding against that and in fact, taking just as hard a stance against that. How do you manage all of that?
Yeah, so I, you know, having served in government, I have a lot of compassion for people who are forced to make communicate a lot of messages with imperfect information. And that is what this pandemic has been. It's been an effort in kind of mass communications with imperfect information that's changing on a daily basis. I think we have to have a lot of, I think, tolerance for new information and tolerance for changes in that information. I think sometimes the whiplash that people feel is an unfortunate side effect of changing information, but that is the reality of the times that we're in. And so I think our job as leaders, as public health leaders, is to continue to evolve the messaging based on new information and continue to express humility about the information. I think one of the challenges that we've seen in the public health messaging is people express a level of definitiveness that is inappropriate for the level of information that we have at the time. And so I, you know, every time I talk about this, I say, well, we, you know, this is the best information we have right now, but as information evolves, our approach may change. And I think that's been a critical missing piece, as we've seen too many individuals making too many definitive statements absent, you know, a full view of what's actually happening and absent the humility around the evolving science and epidemiology. And so again, I think my advice to anyone who's making any kind of public health proclamations at this point, whether they're political or, you know, public health officials, is to just continue to express that humility. I think that humility ultimately builds trust with people. When you are highly definitive and then you change your message a week later in the face of new information, that's when you start to, I think, amplify the mistrust that many people are feeling right now towards public health officials and government officials.
All right. Great insights there, Dr. Sachin Jain of SCAN Health Plan and, of course, our health reporter, Anjali Kamlani. Thanks so much.
Our coverage of the Federal Reserve's Jackson Hole Symposium continues. We want to get over to our Fed reporter, Brian Chung, who's joined by a very special guest. Brian.
Thanks, Shauna. Well, obviously, all eyes on the Jackson Hole Economic Symposium, which is wrapping up today. But we've got a very special guest here in an exclusive interview. Federal Reserve Governor Christopher Waller is here to chat with us a little bit more. How are you, Christopher Waller?
I'm doing great, Brian. How are you?
I'm great. Chris, it's great to have you on the show. I kind of wanted to kick things off with a discussion of the chairman's speech earlier this morning. We did hear the chairman say he felt the economy had made substantial further progress on inflation, but only clear progress on maximum employment. I guess I'm wondering, how does that compare against your thinking on the economic recovery so far?
Well, I agree with Chair Powell on inflation. We definitely have made the progress we wanted after many years of being below 2%, which was our inflation target. We've clearly gone over it this year and probably will in next year. On the employment front, I think we've come a long way. I think that one more good jobs report, if it's in the 850,000 or million, will be sufficient to claim substantial progress in employment for tapering. That's kind of my benchmark. Some others have stated that they would like to wait and see a few more, but when you adjust the labor force and jobs for the early retirements, if we get another million, we will have recovered about 85% of the jobs that were lost. And that took almost 7 years after the last recession. So to me, that's tremendous progress in a very short period of time in the labor market. So if we were to hit that, I would say we're ready to go early this fall.
And that jobs report is going to come out next Friday. And I guess there is also, though, at the same time, the downside risk of Delta, which may bleed through that August data. So is there any sort of risk that the data that you'll get next Friday might actually be short of that 850,000 to 1 million that you're looking for? And how might that maybe change your outlook?
Yeah, so the critical thing I want to stress is that we look at the economic data. We make our policy decisions on that. We don't necessarily look at the virus data except for how it may spill over into the economy. It hasn't necessarily been that good in the past. If you go back to December of last year, we were forecasting potentially a recession in the first quarter, and we had growth of over 6%. So, and that was the worst part of the pandemic. So the economy doesn't necessarily follow the virus that closely. And I kind of have that feeling this time that this is going to have some possible downside risk to the forecast. But my view is it's going to pretty much continue on as it is. There'll be sectors that'll get a particular hit from it. But I think the economy is going to proceed just like it has been.
So if that number, though, at the same time does hit that mark, you did say you'd be ready to go this fall. I'm guessing that implies some sort of announcement in that September 22nd meeting. So then how would you like to structure the taper in terms of maybe how long that taper would last, whether or not you're going to bias towards the agency mortgage-backed securities, given the hotness of the housing market, as opposed to U.S. Treasuries? How would you like to have that structured?
Yeah, so I would like to go early this fall. I don't see any reason that we would need to wait until next year. That's my own views, unless something really bad comes out in the job market report next week, which I just don't expect to happen. So once any financial market impacts, or almost all the financial impact will be at the announcement of taper, whether it's a 4-month taper or a 6-month taper or an 8-month, isn't going to have much price effect. So once you announce it, that's going to be the big impact on the markets. And at that point, my view is to try to go as fast as you can so that we can get the tapering done to give ourselves some optionality for 2022, the second half, in the event, if we need to raise rates. I'm not saying we would, but in the event, we'd like to have some space to do that instead of dealing with a long, drawn-out taper. On MBS, I definitely would like to see MBS tapered faster. I've been advocating for tapering MBS first, but that's not going to happen. So I would prefer a faster pace on MBS and get that done and over with.
So let's talk about inflation. We did get a read from the BEA this morning on personal consumption expenditures clocked in at 3.6 on a core basis, a 4.2% on the headline. Haven't seen that type of pace in over 30 years. How would tapering address that?
So the inflation numbers, we think, are going to cool off in the next few months. We've argued that this was transitory. A lot of reasons. I've argued it. Most of my colleagues in the FOMC have made similar comments. There is a general concern that this is going to last longer. The supply bottlenecks that we're seeing are not unraveling as fast as we thought they would. We're seeing a little more wage pressure starting to come through. All my business contacts are telling me that firms have pricing power for the first time in a decade, and they fully intend to use it. So they fully intend to pass costs through to consumers. So I don't think inflation is going to get worse, and I think it's going to cool off, but I do think it's going to be more persistent than I may have thought back in May.
And you mentioned earlier the idea of giving yourself optionality on a rate hike possibly in the second half of 2022. But what was interesting was that the chairman did outline what might be perceived as a higher bar for liftoff, especially with the new framework, warning that tightening before the labor market kind of had the time to heal as something that could be particularly harmful. So how are you thinking about that as maybe after you start tapering, you then start to look towards eventually normalizing rates?
Right. It's really important to stress that we have two different sets of metrics for taper and liftoff. On the taper, we want substantial progress on the economy. Liftoff is we've pretty much achieved our dual mandate. So for me, a simple example would be I see 85% of jobs recovered as substantial progress. That's not enough to lift off. So I'd want to see us closer to 100% before I would start in taking into account that we should raise rates. So that's what I mean. Those are different standards. Those are different bars. The bar for liftoff is definitely much higher. And then that's also, we're going to be keeping an eye on different distributional effects of policy, of groups kind of move towards where they were in March or February 2020. Or are we seeing a lot of inequality in the way this recovery has gone? Those will be things people will be looking at that maybe they're not looking at necessarily that hard now when it comes to a tapering decision.
And then final question here, financial stability risk. This is a part of the framework as well. A lot of people fixated on the maximum employment and price stability side of things, but that is a big caveat as well. Especially with regards to tapering, do you worry that the length of how long you've been buying purchases has led to any sort of weird pricing in certain corners? Anything that you're watching on that front?
Well, I, like several of my colleagues, have been concerned about the housing market. I mean, these are eye-popping price increases. A lot of it is fundamentals, that you have millennials coming off the sideline for the first time in a decade, kind of a permanent shift from work in the office to work at home. Those are not going to go away anytime soon, and those are driving prices. But I don't think any of this is a financial excess. We're seeing housing prices being driven by a lot of equity, which we did not see in the last housing boom. Something like over 20% of all housing purchases are all cash. So if there's no credit bubbles fueling this, there's really not going to be any threat to the banking system or financial system. The banks are in great shape. I mean, they have capital ratios of 12%. They weathered the storm of the financial crisis well. We're not seeing any excesses in lending in any way, shape, or form. So pretty much the financial system works fine. There are going to be the odd assets that people will point to and look at, particularly crypto assets. But I'm not going to bet financial stability policy on crypto assets.
Probably a good point to clarify there. But Federal Reserve Governor Christopher Waller in an exclusive here on Yahoo Finance. Thanks again for stopping by. Hopefully we'll see you in person at Jackson Hole next year.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Brian, for having me on.